Welcome to City Arts and Lectures, a season of talks and onstage conversations with some of the most celebrated writers, artists, and thinkers of our day, recorded before an audience at the Sydney Goldstein Theater in San Francisco. This week, a conversation with Whoopi Goldberg. This program is being rebroadcast. It was originally recorded in 1987, just after Goldberg's explosive performance in the film adaptation of The Color Purple. Even before Goldberg achieved celebrity status and critical acclaim, she never shied away from voicing her incisive and irreverent perspectives on race, sexism, the film industry, and American politics. In fact, many of the causes she discussed with Mary Lou Manali, a reporter for KGO Radio in San Francisco, remain regrettably relevant today. Goldberg is currently one of the hosts of ABC's The View.
It has been an interesting couple of years for you, ma'am.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you had to pick a time over the last 3 years, I tried to get tickets to see you at the Victoria Theater. What was that, 3 or 4 years ago? They told me, sorry, sold out. Next thing I knew, Newsweek magazine, The Color Purple, Steven Spielberg, Broadway. I mean, if you had to pick one event that catapulted you into something that you thought was going to get crazy, what would that one event have been?
Birth.
The second event, then.
God, it's hard to tell. It's hard to pick one thing because it's all been kind of strange, you know, fast and strange. I don't know, just moving up here did a whole lot for me.
From San Diego.
Yeah, because I hooked up with the Blake Street Hawkeyes, and they, you know, they're such a talented bunch that they gave me lots of leeway to do and experiment. And so that's really the moment. The time I got off the bus in San Francisco and shocked everybody. Because I stayed.
Who was a part of the repertoire that we would know today from the Blake Street Hawkeyes? Which of your characters?
Fontaine, the handicapped girl.
Yeah, they were doing that back then.
Mm-hmm.
That must have been, I hate to use the word because I know you don't like it too much, but pretty avant-garde in those days.
Oh, avant-garde is not a word I'm at all opposed to. Stand-up comedian is what I have a problem with.
Okay. You don't consider yourself a comedian?
No.
An actor?
First and foremost, yeah. That's where most of my training has come from, is in the theater. This other stuff came out of desperation, pretty much. You know, because they kept explaining to me why people couldn't hire me. You know, and finally I decided, well, you know, might as well do something I like to do and that will perhaps highlight what I'm capable of doing. And that's how all of this came about. But wasn't
back up,
a plan.
Back up just a bit. Why weren't people hiring you, and for what weren't they hiring you?
Well, because they, most of the time when you go to audition for plays or something or movies, they have a very specific idea of what they want you to look like. And then, as now, I don't fit it. You know, but what's nice is that people have decided that it's not necessary that you look a specific way, but only that you're talented. For actually, could you put the house lights back up? I much prefer to see who's looking at me. Thank you.
We'll get them up there.
It gets you. Yeah. You can say, "Could you put the house lights back up?" And they do.
Aside from being able to raise the house lights on your command, how has the whole idea of this incredibly, well, it's not that sudden, or long haul, but I mean 5 years, all of a sudden you are a hot property. How has that affected you?
Well, it's made me a little more blasé.
How so?
Well, suddenly I don't have to prove myself anymore. I don't have to prove that I know how to do what I do. I don't have to apologize for being good at what I do. I only have to be good now. I don't have to kiss anybody's butt. I don't have to accept things that I feel are I don't have to lie or be lied to. People will continue to lie to you no matter what you do, but I don't have to accept it. And I can say, I don't need this, and go home, and not worry about it.
You know? I somehow can't imagine you kissing anybody's butt, even when you had to.
I never had to.
Okay, yeah.
But what happens sometimes with fame is that people want you to. They try to make you think that it's necessary for you to do that to maintain whatever stature you have. But for me, the golden thing about what's happened is that I can go back on tour. You know, and that's the one thing that I have that is a saving grace for me, is I don't need to make movies. I can go out on the road and do live shows, you know, so it's not something that my life's blood is, you know, tied into. And that is really boy, I can't even begin to tell you what a safety measure that is.
I'll bet. Security blanket.
Yeah. Well, too, I mean, it means you can say no to stuff. It means you don't have to do certain things, you know. I don't have to really do anything, you know, that I don't want to do. And that's power.
Tell me about going on tour or movies. Or television, major comedy specials. You did the comedy relief thing. You did a couple of things on HBO. I saw you just last week with the Pointer Sisters. How do you make the decisions? Which are going to be the priorities now? What will it be? Money? Will it be exposure? Will it be a chance to do what you want to do? What's your priority for the work you choose?
How silly it is. You know, it's not money, because Uncle Sam takes half of everything you make. So. Yeah. The less I can give to Uncle Sam, the happier I am. I only ask for huge amounts of money when people piss me off.
Sydney, be careful not to annoy her tonight.
No, well, I tell you, an interesting thing is, earlier in the year, you know, I like making movies. I think it's fun. And I've always wanted to do all kinds of different genres. So I find this script. I read in a magazine that they've offered this movie to Tina Turner. And I think, well, I have to look at this script. So I get it. And it's a pretty great script. You know, it's Dirty Harriet, you know. And so I'm, you know, I'm sorry. I know it's not politically correct, but I'm into that. You know, I am. I'm a swashbuckler in my heart. So there I am going, Jesus, sure, I'd sure like to do this. And so I say to these people who have the script, I would really like to do this. I think this would be a lot of fun. There's never been another woman who's done this, and yada, yada, yada. They went on to tell me that in looking at me, they didn't feel I was sexy enough to pull this off. And that they didn't feel I was pretty enough or tall enough or any of this stuff. So cut now to 9 months later. I'm in Holland on my honeymoon. And I get this call saying, you remember that movie you wanted to make, that Dirty Harriet? And I said, yeah. And they said, well, they can't give it to Tina because they feel Tina can't carry this. And they don't want to give it to Cher because she's not right for it. But they'd like you to do it. And my response was, well, they're going to have to pay an ugly woman's price. And they did.
All right.
And that's what I'm working on next.
I read, what you want to talk about that one at all?
Sure.
You're starting that soon, Dirty Harriet? Mm-hmm.
It's called Fatal Beauty. I have subtitled it.
Fatal Beauty. Do you have anything to do with the title?
No, no, no. I've subtitled it Fatal Booty. And it's a cop story. And I've just asked the man who's revising the script. I went to see a film called Platoon, which I thought was incredible. And, yeah, it's good. It's great. If you haven't seen it, do go see it, because, boy, it's really something. And because I've never, there is a new book out now that I didn't know about when I talked to the director, but there have been very few accounts of women in Vietnam. So what I did was I asked the director, rather than have her be a poor black woman who was beaten up by some guy and then she decided to become a cop, was if she could be a vet. And he said yes.
All right.
So that's what the line we're going to try to go through. But she is someone who is looking for this crack dealer who is killing all his children. And that's kind of generally the storyline. And there's, you know, it's pretty butch.
You can carry it. That's
but that's
all right.
Okay, because they gave me a love interest anyway.
Okay.
It's kind of like Sigourney Weaver in Aliens, you know. Because, I mean, no, the psychology behind Aliens is if you're too butch, you're going to die in the first hour or so. If you're black, you're going to die in the first 10 minutes. But if you are butch but have some maternal instincts and have some sexuality towards some guy, then you will last to save the world, see?
All right. And all right.
And the all-time greatest line, this is my favorite line in any movie. You guys have seen it, yeah? Okay, Sigourney Weaver gets into this big metal thing, and she looks at the alien and says, "Get away from her, you bitch!" I was on the floor. I thought, yeah, okay. You know, but the other favorite part is, you know, they have this great shot where they have all these people waking up in this tube. So one guy gets up and he flexes, and then the butch woman gets up and she flexes, and then you get to Sigourney's tube and she's asleep like. And they got on boxer shorts. She's wearing Calvin Klein's. But I had a good time at Aliens, too. I thought it was funny. I thought it was a big comic book, which I liked. And I hope there are some comic book pieces in Fatal Beauty, because after all, I like that.
Yeah.
You know, I like that. So I only have 4 more genres to go, and then I can start again.
All right. Talk to us a little bit about The Color Purple. I read a big article in Newsweek magazine, one of the first big national things that was about you, the sidebar story in Newsweek, in the review of The Color Purple. The Newsweek reviewer had some good things and some bad things to say about the movie, but a lot of great things to say about you. Riveting, haunting, et cetera, et cetera. You had said, when the book was first published, that you would play the dirt in The Color Purple.
Mm-hmm.
You originally wanted the role of Sophia.
Mm-hmm.
But you had to be content with the lead.
Yeah.
Why did you want the Sophia part?
Because I didn't feel like I could carry a film. I didn't feel like I really could take Celia and do anything with her. And Sophia had much more fun in the book.
She got knocked around a little bit, too.
Yeah, but she kicked butt. Yeah. You know, she was pretty cool in the book.
You have a scene in there where you at least verbally kick a little butt.
Yes, and it's funny. He waited to shoot that into the last days, so I was ready to talk.
Yeah, I bet.
You know, I was ready to say something to someone. You know.
Yeah. Overall, that was a major motion picture. I mean, Steven Spielberg, major budget. Overall, were you happy with it?
I was. You know, a lot of people had a lot of stuff to say about it. But the major thing about The Color Purple is that, A, had Steven Spielberg not made it as big and gone with the Wendy as he did, the people in Bucktussle, Idaho, and Kicker, Kansas, you know, would never have gone to see it. Those people have gone to see the movie, and they're now reading the book. The book is selling like hotcakes. People who would never have gotten to it, you know. Now, when we talk about this stuff, we're all talking as urban dwellers who are people who are somewhat intellectual. The people I'm talking about are not people who we know a whole lot about. You know, I mean, I'm not... You know, I went to a thing in Las Vegas. They have this thing where all these people, distributors, who have these little tiny theaters all over the country, came. Women from Texas, women from Mississippi, black, white, young, old, teenagers, were saying, you know, when this book came out, I didn't think it had anything to do with me. But it has a lot to do with me. They went to see the movie and were moved, you know. So when you think about what you've read and what you see, you must think past the people you know, the people in your circle or the people who fit your intellectual thought pattern, the people that you know in your own realm, and look to what it's done in the long view. And that's why, for me, Color Purple, it has problems, you know.
I think one of the problems that a lot of the critics, and we'd be a little remiss if we didn't deal with it briefly tonight, because it's not supposed to be a sober evening, is the bad rap that black men took.
They didn't take a bad rap. That's pile of
You don't think?
No. Look, it's not like Alice Walker went in and wrote something that wasn't true. This is fact. You know, this is fact. This is something that happens in white homes, Spanish homes, black homes. It happens everywhere. Now, why nobody say anything about Purple Rain is beyond me. Because this is contemporary black men.
Could okay? be nobody saw it, that's
oh,
why.
This, no. I wish that were the case. I wish that were the case because then I could be a lot kinder to the people who bad rap Color Purple. But in fact, Purple Rain was about a contemporary black man who threw women in the garbage can, threw them in the river, made fools of them, talked to them like they was dirt.
Yeah.
Nobody said a word.
Yeah.
Pop Nobody culture. Said a word.
Teenage pop culture.
Well,
whatever.
I mean, but, you know, that's garbage, you know. If you're going to talk about how people are portrayed, then you must look at the broad spectrum. This is why I had such a tough time going and getting this award from the NAACP, you know, because I thought they were just this particular chapter was full of
Because they were part of the criticism.
Oh, man, they were the main criticism before the movie came out. They didn't even go to the screening. You know, this movie is not about something that Alice Walker fell asleep and had a dream. You know? And it does happen. People do beat other people. But you'll notice there's only one instance that I can remember that you see Mr. do anything to her on the screen. Only one. And it's in a field where the church is behind her and she's reading the letter. It's the only time you see him do anything to her, you know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I just...
But to see Danny Glover, whom I fell in love with in the
he's
other
great.
Movie with What's Your
and
Name?
You know what the NAACP has done for Danny Glover?
Huh.
It has totally wiped him out of The Color Purple. Do you, when you read stuff about it, you never read anything about Danny Glover. You never read anything about the black man in this movie.
Hmm.
Never. And Danny put in a hell of a performance. A hell of a performance.
Yeah, he did.
As did Willard Pierre. But, you know, people are so quick. They were mad because Spielberg got the movie made. Now, what they didn't tell you was that a lot of independent black producers were approached with Color Purple and turned it down.
Hmm.
Didn't want to make it. So all I can say is I take my hat off to Steven Spielberg for giving me a job.
Does the politics in that industry get to you often?
Not anymore.
No. Because, refer back to paragraph one in the, yeah.
Lights.
Right. Yeah. We got it. There's an interesting thing that happens when people are born in the right era or the wrong era. Some people are their generation's personification. Marilyn Monroe in the 50s, for instance. Lenny Bruce went to jail for saying a lot of the words that you say very casually today. Do you sometimes... That's true.
Like...
Yeah. We did it. All right, it's over. It's done. All right.
That didn't make you nervous, did it?
No, it didn't make me nervous. But I'm glad it's done. I'm glad it's it.
Because I might say it one more time or so.
Not the 11-letter one?
You.
Okay.
I might say the M-word, too.
The M-word?
Don't push me, Marilyn.
The C-word? Well, we're going to talk to Fontaine in a little bit, and I have
a
suggestion.
I don't know.
No? You don't think so?
I don't
so?
Know.
Oh, you don't?
Those guys they're pretty much on vacation.
Oh, no.
Yeah, you know what happens is when I go to work on something else, they disappear for a while.
Not even if I talk dirty, will Fontaine appear?
No, but you might get somebody you can't handle. Just
okay.
kidding, just
okay.
kidding.
What am I doing sparring with this woman?
I'm
I know
just
this is not my role here.
I'm just
I forgot
teasing.
What my question was.
No, you didn't. Come on.
I know. Era, right era.
Mm-hmm.
What if you had been born 20 years, 30 years earlier than you would have?
I'd probably be in jail.
Yeah. For saying those words, Whoopi. That's what
no,
I said.
No, probably not for saying those words, but for not being able to understand why I couldn't do what I wanted to do. I'm glad I wasn't born in that era, because people like Louise Beavers and Moms Mabley and Hattie McDaniel and Butterfly McQueen transferred the world in a way that the world could deal with. You know, and if not for them and people like Step and Fetch It and all these people that in the 60s nobody wanted to talk about, yeah. Without them, I would not be here. You know, you're welcome, girl. It's true, you know, but in the 60s, you know, everybody said, oh, no, Uncle Tom's here. No, no. But nobody realized that Hattie McDaniel was one of the highest paid actresses in Hollywood.
And one of the best of that character actor.
No, just the idea that she made more money than Clark Gable, I thought was incredible.
She did?
Mm-hmm.
No kidding.
No.
Sorry, no.
Yeah. See, you can say those words.
I can say it, yes. You know, I have friends in this audience who are peeing their pants right now that you're accusing me of not talking like that. But they're getting
a big
kick out of
it. Oh, you should have heard her backstage. She said the M word and everything.
I even said it without all the syllables.
Yes.
God.
So, no, I'm glad I was born in this era. Sometimes I think I would have been good in the 30s, but
what would you have done in the 30s? I mean, seriously, what would you have done? Would you have been an actor in the 30s, do you think?
Probably.
Would you have been playing the black maids and
I don't know. You know, there was a whole... Depends on if we're in film. I mean, Paul Robeson did an incredible thing in Showboat.
Yeah.
You know, and he's the only person, and the only song you remember is his, you know. So I don't know if I would have done that in the 30s, but I know I probably would have been an actor, maybe with the Mercury Theater or something, Houseman and those guys. But that's also, you know, me thinking of myself in a whole other genre.
You said that you probably would have been in jail, and you were joking a little bit, but you had your share of trouble with the law in
well,
the past.
Well, just because they make stupid laws. You know, they make stupid laws that I don't agree with.
Which ones got you in trouble?
Well, a couple. But most recently was protesting in Berkeley against UC's monies in South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
That got you thrown in jail, did it?
Well, they didn't throw me. They delicately ushered me. Very, very delicately. Miss Goldberg, I have to put you under arrest. Okay. could you follow me, please, Miss Goldberg?
That's better than throwing, yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, nobody wants to put their hands on me now, you know. That makes people nervous, nor do I want to put my hands on anyone now, you know.
You got politically active in the last election. You were stumping around the state for the Clean Water Bill.
I've always been politically active. It's just famous now.
It's just that, yeah, Newsweek wasn't covering it.
Now people give a about it, you know.
So, yeah.
It's very silly. But, yeah, I'm tired of dirty water. I don't want little amoebas floating around in what I drink. I'm tired of it. And there was no law governing these people telling them they had to tell you when they dump stuff. Nobody had to tell you anything. I was shocked, you know. I thought, well, I don't want to I don't like that. And then we met some families, you know, whose children were affected by the chemicals in the water, you know, children without limbs, you know, children born with one lung or one eye, you know. I don't want to see that, you know. I don't want that. I don't think that's right. So Jane Fonda called me up, which was a real trip, and said, hi, this is Jane Fonda. And I said, get out of here. Come on. Get out of my face, you Jane Fonda. And it was. It was. And she said, you know, well, you've been doing a lot of work and stuff, and I wanted to find out if you would be kind enough to join me and these people to educate people about Prop 65. And I said, yeah, okay.
Save me a space on the truck. Right?
Yeah, man, yeah. You know, and it worked.
You know, as I talk to you, I can see where Goldberg came from. But where did Whoopi come from? Where did the whole name come from?
God.
God. It did not. You made
it
up.
No, it did. God.
Oh, okay. The God within you.
God.
I get it.
God.
Okay.
Goldberg's my mom's name. That's her name.
Just God. I mean, really, God. Okay.
Why do people... it's very funny to find Americans are so shocked that a black person could possibly be black and something else.
I mean, yeah.
You know, we've been here for, what, 200 years? Is that right? Yeah, you know, so we mix with everything. Everybody's taking a shot at us. You know, it's only in America that it's a surprise. You know, there are Sephardic Jews all over the world, black Jews. There are black Buddhists. There are, you know, religion has no color. Religion doesn't know.
No, that's true.
Religion's in your heart.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why are you so shy about people knowing your real name?
I'm not. I just didn't think it was anybody's business.
Well, but your face now.
I had a name.
Everybody
they
knows.
Knew where to write.
They know.
They knew what to call me. But no, they wanted to. The people dug, People Magazine, came out to my house to do an interview with me, and somehow got a hold of it and put it in the paper. But that's the last vestige of privacy I had, and I wanted to keep that and didn't understand the fervor over wanting to know that. I mean, it's like asking me my breast size, you know, or how often do you get menstrual cramps? I mean, why? You know, it's nobody's business. You know?
But that's again the part, that's the role that fame plays, I imagine. Your privacy is just down the tubes unless you can hang on to it.
Well, I tried.
Yeah.
Pissed a lot of people off in doing it. So now they know. Are you going to ask me my name?
No, I'm not. I know your name.
Yes, I will tell you.
But I'll keep it a secret. Can I respect your privacy?
Oh, yeah, sure.
I do. I respect your privacy.
Sure,
I'll tell
sure.
everybody I know if they want to know.
Yeah, well, see? My name
I'm
is
teasing.
Karen. My name is Karen Johnson.
I think that's a little bit odder than Whoopi Goldberg.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, you look like a weirdo. That's what I'm curious about. Where you made it up. That's the story I heard. You made up Whoopi. Whoopi, anyway.
Mm-hmm.
That suits you. It's a wonderful name for you.
It suits me when I want it to.
Okay, where did
when I want to be the other person, I'm that too. Just out of the blue, kind of.
I mean, just really, you just woke up one day and said, "Whoopi." That's
sort
it.
Sort of.
See, I'm a left-brained person. You have to understand that. I don't think like you. I need to know where these things came from.
Well, dear. There I was in bed with a guy.
Uh-huh.
And he screamed my name, and I screamed Whoopi. No,
what?
Some people, actually, I'll tell you. I was doing a show, I was doing Christmas Carol in San Diego, and we were talking about names we would never name our kids. And that's how Whoopi came up. And they said, but this name fits you, because I make that sound that Whoopi cushions make when I don't like something. And that's how I got it, in all honesty.
What were you like as a little kid?
Pretty much weird, pretty weird.
How weird? I mean, did you have friends? Were you a loner? Were you?
I was pretty much a loner. Pretty much a loner. Always liked acting. Always liked actors. I grew up in a real mixed neighborhood. Lots of interesting people. Geraldine Page lived in my neighborhood. James Earl Jones lived in my neighborhood. Rip Torn lived in my neighborhood.
Not a poor kid then, huh?
What do you mean?
Well, I mean,
you mean
Rip Torn, Geraldine Page, you didn't grow up in no slum.
Why is it people think actors are rich all the time? No, these were working people. I grew up in a working class neighborhood. My mother was a single parent. She worked as a nurse. We in New York didn't really have slums until I was much older. You know?
You're not that old, though. I mean, there was...
31.
That's not that old.
No, but it's older. I'm saying that when I was eight, there were not slums like there are slums now. You know what I mean?
Urban blight hadn't taken over the way.
No, not quite.
Yeah.
It was just starting. But I always lived downtown. So I lived in the projects. I grew up in the projects.
We've all heard stories about you being... quote-unquote, a welfare mother before the big fame hit. Was that, I mean, seriously, how bad were things for you then?
I didn't have any money.
That's pretty bad. You couldn't tell people to turn the house lights up then.
Yeah, I could.
Yeah.
No, I was on welfare because I wanted to act. And the jobs that I was not really qualified for, you know, I could never be an accountant because I wasn't interested in it. I've worked in banks, I've laid brick, I've worked in morgues, but always jobs that I could have with the hours I wanted. And I'm not a high school graduate, and so 10 years ago, if you were not a high school graduate, nobody wanted to really deal with you. So to supplement the money that I made, I went on welfare. Mm. I didn't grow up in a welfare home, so it was like took me a year to get it together to go to welfare, you know. But I spent 8 years on welfare, and I'm not embarrassed about it or ashamed. I'm real glad they were there, you know, because it helped.
You really did do hair in a mortuary, though. You mm-hmm. worked on, I read that about you. That sounds like a wild job.
I also worked in strip joints and bars. Worked a lot of cheesy places. I'm not ashamed of it. I raised a pretty decent kid. You know, she's a nice girl. And I did what I had to do.
When did you start doing the surfer chick?
5 years ago.
Blake Street, Hawkeye. Mm-hmm. How did she get born? I mean, how did that happen?
There were pro-life people across the street from my house at Herrick Hospital. And they were out there for every day for a week, from like 6:30 in the morning until 6 at night. And I just got tired of it, and I went out, and as they handed out pamphlets, I handed out hangers. Mostly because, you know, I will not argue with anybody who has a thought or who feels a specific way. But I do resent people, A, forgetting why abortion was legalized. There was a reason for that, was to make it safe and clean for women who felt they needed to do it, you know, that people would want to return their daughters or their mothers to hangers in dirty bathrooms in the park, to me is barbaric. That these people are not offering alternatives like sex education in schools, real sex education. I mean, it's coming about now because of AIDS, you know, because suddenly people are aware. They have to educate these kids. This is pretty interesting. I once taught a class talking to teenagers about sex, excuse me, and started talking about the safety value a couple years ago in oral sex, which they will not talk about when they talk about sex education. Now, I thought that was a viable way for young people. I did. You know, I thought that should be an alternative to the sex that these kids were practicing without safety, you know. Now, nobody wanted to hear that at the time. Teenagers and sex is real scary because when it feels good, they're not going to think about, oh, God, I didn't put my diaphragm in, you know, or, honey, put on a condom. They're not thinking about that. They're thinking about, you know, oh, my God, you know. And because that's the nature of sex. That's the nature of feeling good sexually. And sex is great. And kids are they're gonna go out and have sex. So here we got all these teenagers getting pregnant, you know, and they're going, well, oh, that's that rubber thing? Oh, I thought it was a purse cleaner. You know, and it sits, you know. So that's why I do the surfer chick, is to remind people about the alternative to safe, free abortion. You know, that's the alternative, is a hanger. Yeah. And what better way to present it to people and make them think is through the eyes of a teenager.
And a white teenager.
No, just a teenager.
But, I mean, she is a white teenager.
Though. Why?
I don't know. I just always assumed she was. Because she sounds like a mindless little San Diego beach bimbo, I suppose.
Well, there are black beach bimbos.
Are there?
There are Chinese beach bimbos.
Are there real?
Yeah. Go out to the beach.
I thought they were all blonde. It's too cold at these beaches. Are you kidding?
No, go check some. These are just kids. Kids of all colors and shapes and sizes that are out there mindlessly doing stuff and seeking some kind of help that is not readily forthcoming anymore. And that scares me. That scares me for me. That scares me for you and your kids. And I just wanted to have people think, regardless of what their decision on abortion is just think about it. Just think about the alternative. That's my concern, and that's why I did her.
All of your characters have, what, a little bit of you, a lot of you, less or more of you in each of them, but there must be some of you in each of your characters.
Oh, there's mostly the world and things that scare me. That's what comes out of their mouths. Things that scare me, people's reaction to handicapped people. I understand that reaction, you know, because people are made uncomfortable by anything that is not supposedly perfect. But as my lady says, perfect is in the eye of the beholder, you know, but it's our attitudes. I mean, we used to shut, you know, handicapped people up, you know, in institutions and do all kinds of weird stuff to them. So people see somebody in a wheelchair come and they're scared. So they kind of, you know. But the idea of this girl was to remind people that she's a person. She's just physically disabled. That's all. She likes to have fun. She likes to go out with her friends. And once people remember that, they're at peace with it because maybe it'll mean the next time they come across a handicapped person, it won't frighten them. They won't feel like it's something that's going to rub off. You know, because a lot of us are like that, you know. But I live in an area that has tons of wheelchair people. And so you just, they go whizzing by and they wave.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that if you're living in Berkeley, had anything to do with your own awareness?
Oh, yeah, we have the Center for Independent Living there.
Right.
And, you know, a lot of my friends said, well, when are you going to do something, you know, tell people about us? Mm. I said, well, yeah, okay, yeah, boy, yeah, okay, because I didn't want to be perceived as someone who was making fun. And so that's kind of what happened.
That's one of the many things you share with Lily Tomlin. She does a character, too, who is handicapped.
That's what I hear.
And you've been compared by a number of critics before because you do a similar kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Do you like that comparison? Does it affect you at all? Would you rather they didn't compare you to Lily Tomlin?
No. Doesn't bother me. Doesn't. I mean, I don't know. It's okay.
One way or the other.
Yeah.
How about Richard Pryor? I hear that sometimes too.
Yeah, I've heard that too.
Same way. Doesn't bother you.
Yeah.
Off your back.
Well, yeah. I mean, school.
I think it's wonderful that you're from Berkeley and you smoke.
It's only because I smoked before I got to Berkeley. I think that's pretty silly. I think it's pretty silly. I understand why it's in existence. It would just be nice if people were more polite about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. People in restaurants come and go, God damn it, you smoke. Put that cigarette out. And I say, okay, bend over. You know? Whereas if someone says to me, God, you know, smoke really bothers me, I'll put it out. But there's no general law about smokers. You must deal with smokers on an individual basis. You know, and where you see an a**hole, deal with them. You know, but where you see someone who is willing to hear you, deal with them accordingly. That would be really swell. Then there wouldn't be a camp of them and us. It would all be us, see? But that's just my way of looking at it.
What would Fontaine have to say about Nancy Reagan's anti-drug campaign?
I would have to say I'm glad. Fontaine would say he was very happy that she was alive enough to think about an anti-drug campaign. You know? I mean, the thing that you have to do, you know, you can't just randomly say these people are garbage. You have to take what they say that is right and righteous and deal with that. And where they're wrong and small-minded, that's what you have to point up. I'm happy for anybody who's trying to get kids not to deal with these drugs. I'm glad for anybody. I don't care who it is, you know. And if that's the way she can do it, if that's how she can bring the message, I'm happy. Because it means somewhere, whether it's a Republican kid or a communist kid, she might reach somebody, you know. She might save one kid. If Nancy Reagan can save one kid, I thank her. I thank her. I'm not going to put her down for that. You know, she's got other quirks that I disagree with.
Such as?
Well, I mean, she just is, for me, a drip. There's nothing, you know. I mean, I like Lady Bird Johnson, you know. Lady Bird had some fire. Lady Bird said, Lyndon, put some flowers on them highways. You know. Lyndon, I want you to give some money to the arts. Now, Nancy Reagan was an actress, and so was Ronald Reagan. Where's our arts budget? Where's our cultural budget? You know?
Well, for that matter, where's our drug money budget?
Hmm?
For that matter, where's our drug money budget?
That's just, well, that's slowly coming along. That's slowly coming along because that's one of her little umbrellas, you know?
Yeah.
Good. That's good, you know? If we can get him to leave that damn missile alone, then it would be greater, you know?
But he just got done saying that the drug
program... Oh, I know. Wasn't that a hysterical...
Yeah,
I swear I thought I was looking at splitting image. Is that a spitting image? Just kind of watching him go like this. And watching those people jump up. It looked like a Hitler rally. I swear to God, it looked like a Hitler rally. Every time he said boo, they say, yay! You know, Heil Ronnie. It was very bizarre. Very bizarre. And notice how he didn't mention money going anywhere else from Iran. I thought that was very slick.
Yeah, that was,
you know,
a little vague.
Like, oh, yeah, we made a couple of mistakes, but it, yeah. So... You know, and what? Ted Kennedy with his great, did you see his face?
Yeah.
He sat there like this. That was very funny. I wish I could have been there, you know, because, you know, sometimes when you go to the movies, you have a row of ladies who sit and talk to the screen. That's what I would have done. Now, Ronnie, you know you need to stop that honey. You know.
Would you like to run for office someday?
Not a prayer.
No?
Mm-mm. No.
Why not?
Because I will do my little part from this side of the fence. I don't want to be president or senator or councilperson or mayor. You know, I don't want to be any of those things. I just want to be a voice.
Who do you like for president in '88? Are you paying attention to that yet?
No. I'm waiting to see who pops up.
Any feelings about Gary Hart? Mario Cuomo?
Mario Cuomo. He'd be interesting.
Yeah?
He'd be interesting. I think it would be a very tough gig to be president. You know? I think it'd be a very tough gig because, first of all, you have to prove your power. That's the first thing. You have to show the people that you are, in fact, in charge. And then when it hits the fan, you say, well, they did it. I didn't have anything to do with this. What happened was the Senate. See, that's who messed up. See, that's how that works. I think the most interesting thing to do right now politically would be to run the Reagan-Carter debate again on national television.
Wouldn't that be, though? Yeah.
That's what I would like to see happen.
Yeah, it'd be interesting.
Just to see, just to remind ourselves of what was said. I would just be interested in that. That's what I hope. If there's any people from television here, think about that. Think about that. Just, you know, a little bit of primetime stuff. Say, well, let's put this on. Let's kill the Brady Bunch for tonight and put this on.
Let's see. I want to talk to you about your career a little bit, too. You won't do your characters. I mean, even if I plead or cajole?
No.
Not even a little bit of that?
No.
Okay.
I'm not prepared. Other people are coming out, though. That's pretty good.
I've heard a couple of them. I've heard a couple.
You got the bird.
I heard a little bit of a surfer chick too for a second there, but you caught yourself instead.
Popular.
One of the things I love about the stuff that you do is your command of accents, whether it's German or French or surfer chick or whatever. Where did you pick that up? Have you been doing that your whole life? Is it just a gift, as they say?
Yeah, I think so. It's always been. It's always been there.
Living in New York help?
Probably.
I saw you do a couple of Yiddish things on television once.
Sure.
It's a very dormant district.
I grew up in a melting pot, so you heard a little bit of everything. And it's fun. You know, I like to test them out in banks. Because if you can go up to a bank teller and try to cash a check in a dialect like this and it doesn't flinch them, then you're doing fine.
Ah, Scotty.
That was for Scotty. Yeah. There's a great guy back here called Scotty who's also from Glasgow, which is where I was performing at one time. And so we were back there talking. I'll tell you a quick story. I'll tell you in this dialect. This way you don't feel disappointed if I don't do the surfer chick. We get to the station in Glasgow and we're going to something called Mayfest, and we see these people sitting around with things that say Mayfest on them. So we're sitting and we're waiting to be picked up, but we thought, well, they're just wearing buttons, you know, to advertise. And we're waiting to be picked up by these people from Mayfest. So an hour and a half goes by and finally it's like, God damn, where are they? And so we walk up to these people and we say, look, you're wearing a Mayfest button. Do you know anything about these people? Do you know a number or something? They said, well, we're here from Mayfest. We're supposed to pick up Whoopi Goldberg. And I said, well, damn, that's me. The woman looked at me and said, we're expecting a man. We thought you were going to be a little Jewish man. Nobody told us you're a black woman. My God, we're sitting across from you all this time. Let's go. Oh, God.
True story, right? You toured Europe, and you had a number, the Schwarze story, I know is normally told by Fontaine, but could you tell the Schwarze story however you're comfortable telling it tonight?
Well, I have a new Schwarze story.
Okay.
I went back to Europe, which was one of the scariest experiences I've had in a long time. It's very much like pre-war Germany right now. While we were in Holland, we heard stories going on at the football games, which is the soccer matches, of big banners saying we're going to kill the Jews, Holland for the Dutch. Experienced a lot of anti-color, anti-sex in Italy, in Holland, which was really scary. And so this is my Schwarze story new to Holland. I've just gotten married recently. My husband happens to be Dutch, so we had to stop in Holland. And it was around, you know, their equivalent of Christmas. And the story that Dutch parents tell their children is that if they're not good, Schwarze Piet is going to come and put them in a bag and take them to Spain. Now, Schwarze Piet is this black guy with these huge red lips and these big bulging eyes and hair like this. So many a Dutch child was nervous when they saw me. Now, what Schwarze Piet can do, Schwarze Piet can walk up the walls, he can climb down things and do all kinds of stuff. Now, there are many different races in Holland, but never is Schwarze Piet played by black people. It's all white people in black makeup, which I thought was hysterical. So the first day we're walking down the street and there's one of those cutout cartoons of Schwarzenegger in the window. All these black Dutch people are walking by, kind of just, and I stopped and went, because I thought this must be a joke. But it wasn't a joke. This was real. And these kids were scared of me because they thought I was going to put them in a bag and take them to Spain. And I must say, I didn't do a whole lot to...
You didn't teach those little Dutch children any words.
There's a devilish in me, you know. Yeah. Just periodically the air hits me and that exorcist thing happens to me. And it's like you look over at a kid and go, eh, eh. No, I didn't do that. I wanted to, but I didn't. But Europe is very scary right now.
How recently were you there? Now you're talking.
Yeah, Christmas. It's very frightening. Very frightening. And I'll probably deal with that in the next piece that I do. Just because
same characters? New characters?
Maybe. I don't know yet. I don't know yet. Whatever strikes me. It's just so... To look at this century, to look at the First World War, to look at the Second World War, to look at Vietnam... To look at South Africa, to look at the events which lead up to some of the most incredible things that have happened here, the Civil Rights Movement. If you run footage of the Civil Rights Movement and Germany pre-war, it's
too
like
similar.
One movie.
Yeah.
It's like one movie. That people are still fighting for that in the world is scary. To look at South Africa, what is being run on television about what's going on and been going on, and to look at what's on TV now with, you know, there's what the hell is the name of PBS? Eye on the Prize. If you took the narration out, it would be the same thing. You know, it's one, I mean, it's a continuous thing, and then you add the Jews to that, and then you add all these other people in the world to that, and it's one long film, you know, and to that there are so many things that are happening in our government that could take away certain rights, I mean, as well as the possibility of losing the right to safe abortion. Because my attitude is not the short term, but the long-term effects. As soon as one right disappears, then people find reasons to pry other rights out, you know? So there goes the vote for black and women and men who are under 6 feet tall, you know? Because someone decides, well, I don't think that's right. I don't think men over 6 feet should vote. And they get 55 other people, and it sounds stupid. It sounds really stupid. But if you think of all the things that have happened in our world, you know, if you think about it, it's not stupid. It's very possible. And I know sometimes I think to myself that I'm just a paranoid. But it's history, you know. It has happened. Things like color and religious beliefs, you know. Millions of people. Children being blown up in churches in the South. It's so stupid, you know. So that anything is possible. People forget, you know, people forget. We were very close to an interesting period when all of the car places, all the factories shut down because all those folks who had been talking such stuff about the welfare system and saying, well, you know, this is the government is right, and then all these farms started disappearing and all these people went on welfare and suddenly met one another one-to-one and said, well, hell, I'm on welfare and I want to work, you know, but there's no jobs out there. There are people, an acquaintance I listened to talk about all the homeless people who are out there who just didn't want to get a job. You know, and I thought, you are living in the sand, buddy. You're this close. You know, you're that close to losing what you got. You know, someone could decide your car dealership doesn't mean you know, they're not buying any more cars like yours. And you're gone. House is gone. I mean, it happens overnight to people. And it, you know, homelessness has no color, no ethnic background, it's families, it's children, it's men and it's women, it's us, you know, and that people forget about that because they're living okay for the time being. But there are more homeless people in the United States now than there were during the Depression. More, and growing in rapid numbers, you know.
Is that why you did Comedy Relief?
Yes, and because I want to know that when this gig is done, this star fame and is over, and I hit on hard times, and maybe there will be a time when I won't be able to keep it together. I want some backup. You know, I want some backup, man. I've been on welfare, you know. I've been without money. So it's not outside of my realm of thinking that it could be that way again. But I want to know that there's someone out there who's going to do something, you know. I want to do something. I want to make sure my back is covered. I want to make sure my kids' back is covered.
How do we get that done, though, Whoopi? I mean, without letting this thing get off onto a serious political discussion for too much longer, to use the Berkeley expression, whose consciousness has to be raised? Do people
it's
have to
done.
Pay more attention?
The consciousness is raised. You cannot avoid it. You cannot avoid it, you know. People can say stuff, but they know. They know what's going on.
You think they do?
Yeah, you can't help. You can't help but know.
But it's them. It's not me. It's like you said before. It's always the other guy.
Well,
it's not
but
my
you see, the idea that Comic Relief raised several million dollars tells you that people know it's them. You know, you do what you do. If you got old clothes, take them to the shelters. You know, if you got canned goods, something that's been in your closet, you know, some Chef Boyardee, you know, take it out. Yeah. Put it where it can be, you know, just whatever you can do. It's not saying you're going to change everything, but you can make one little tiny stance. Now, several billion people make one little tiny stance. Yeah. That's a billion people's stance. It's not bad.
You've been listening to A Conversation with Whoopi Goldberg. This program was recorded on January 29th, 1987, at the Herbst Theater in San Francisco. These broadcasts are produced by City Arts and Lectures in association with KQED Public Radio, San Francisco. Executive producers are Kate Goldstein Breyer and Holly Mulder Wallen. Director of Communications and Design is Alexandra Washkin. Production and Communications Assistant is Juliet Gelfman Rondazzo. The post-production director is Nina Thorson. The Sydney Goldstein Theater Technical Director, Steve Eckerd. House Manager, Lucy Faulkner. The Recording Engineer is Jim Bennett. Theme music composed and performed by Pat Gleason. The Founding Producer is Sydney Goldstein. City Arts and Lectures programs are supported by grants for the arts of the San Francisco Hotel Tax Fund. Additional funding provided by the Wallace Alexander Gerbode Foundation, the Mimi and Peter Hawes Fund, the Bernard Osher Foundation, and the Friends of City Arts and Lectures. Support for recording and post-production of City Arts and Lectures is provided by Robert Mailer Anderson and Nicola Miner. To attend a live program, see who is coming next, or find out more about our podcast, visit our website at cityarts.net. That's cityarts.net.